It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Emily Winslow is best known as a crime novelist, having written the books The Whole World, The Start of Everything, and The Red House. But in 1992, she was a Carnegie Mellon University drama student whose life was changed one January night when she was brutally raped by a man she did not know. She waited 20 years to find out who he was and that she was not his only victim. In her latest book, Emily Winslow describes how DNA testing of backlogged rape kits brought her attacker to justice. She joins me now to discuss Jane Doe January, My 20-Year Search for Truth and Justice. Emily Winslow, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
I think the best way to start this conversation is to have you explain what a rape kit is, how it is assembled, and how yours was created.
When somebody goes to the police and hopefully then to the hospital afterward, a rape kit will be created with their permission, of course, which will collect evidence that can hopefully be used to identify the attacker if that's in question, or to prove that the attack indeed did happen. So it's a matter of collecting, combing, or plucking, swabbing, to try to get anything that's going to have DNA on it. And hopefully you're going to find part of the victim, yes, but also, if you're lucky, part of the attacker.
You did not know the man who raped you. It happened in 1992 in Shadyside when you were a CMU student. How were you attacked by this man?
He followed me home. I left my apartment one night to get change of a dollar so I could do my laundry. He saw me exit the building, and then when I came home, he followed me in as if he were a tenant and then broke into my apartment.
You wrote that after this happened, you made the decision that you would let yourself be a mess for 1 year. After that, you say, I had to get it together. How did you arrive at that decision? Why 1 year?
Because it's a nice round time frame. But I'll be honest, I was a mess for longer than a year. But that was my goal. I had the goal of a year. And what was nice about that, it's not just about disciplining myself and saying, okay, the year's done, now I've got to be mature. But it meant that during that first year, to not berate myself for falling apart. I just had complete freedom to feel whatever I felt and want whatever I wanted.
How difficult was it for you to move on with your life?
I was very lucky, not only to be surrounded by wonderful, supportive people, but that, yeah, I was in acting school, you know, and actors are very articulate about strong emotions and deep, hard things. And so it was something that we all talked about. There was nothing secretive. There was no shame. It was something that was openly talked about with both students and faculty. And having that as this foundation of just, this is a piece of my life. This is a thing that happened, but my life is full of other things as well, was an enormous comfort.
In the 20-year interim between when this happened and the man was identified, you kept in touch with the police, calling them every couple of years to see if there had been any developments in your case. Describe what that was like.
It was very difficult. Talking on the phone sometimes can be very hard. You never know who's going to answer. And every time I phoned it was always different detectives, because people will cycle through. You know, the sex assault unit is a tough unit. And so every time I phoned, it was never the same people. And I would just have to start from scratch. And they would never have heard of these Shadyside rapes from 1992. So I'd have to bring them up to speed. And then they'd find the file. And they were always very nice. I really want to stand up for the Pittsburgh police and say everyone in the sex assault unit has been kind and respectful and really seemed to care. But once my case became old, you know, they had this current caseload that there just weren't enough resources.
What has changed regarding the DNA database between then and now, and how has Pennsylvania law changed?
So when my rape kit was created in 1992, there was no criminal DNA database. So there was no point to testing my kit. The way DNA works is it's by comparison. So unless you have a suspect, or a pool of suspects, such as in a DNA database, as the FBI created, called CODIS, there was no point in doing the testing. So first of all, my kit went untested, not because people didn't care, but because it simply, it wasn't, there wasn't anything they could have done with the results. It was in the late 90s that you had states creating their own databases and the FBI coming online with CODIS and then the states hooking into CODIS. And so by, you know, 98, 99, that's when it started becoming like, okay, now we can bring this evidence that doesn't have anybody to compare to. We can now do something with it. But the old kits, they had just become such a backlog. Just keeping up with the normal work was a huge effort. And while it frustrated me for a very long time that I couldn't get my kit in the queue, I understand that it was not because people didn't care. It's because there was a limit.
So now it's September 12th, 2013. Your case is more than 20 years old, and the police are calling you to say that they had had identified and arrested the stranger who raped you. It's a man named Arthur Fryer. What was it like for you, after all that time, to get that call and to find out the identity of your attacker?
That is the call I had been wanting for years and years and years. So that was just good news, full stop. It was good news. And of course, I Googled right away, you know, and there, he's not the only person with that name. So lots of faces came up. So it was like, it was a bit like a lineup, you know, and right away I saw his face and I said, oh, that's him. That's him. I know it. And, but there was also, there had been two attacks that year in Shadyside, very near to one another geographically and very similar. And he was actually being arrested for her case, not mine. My case was still in question, but the attacks were so similar, the police were feeling pretty confident that he would match my evidence. But that was still in question. So while I was thrilled to hear from the police and thrilled to learn who he was, there was also this tension of not knowing if my evidence would still be viable. There was this tension of wondering, is he going to go to prison, but not for me? And that was very hard.
Right. You write that, quote, all I want to do is catch up to the other case, to charge him together with the other woman, with the other known victim once he's extradited. I would hate for him to get put in prison, and all I later get to do is add years to the sentence. Explain why this mattered so much to you, because some people might say, well, as long as the guy gets locked away, what difference does it make?
Because it was personal. What he did to me was personal, and I wanted what was done to him to be personal, too.
Your evidence, after more than 20 years in a freezer, manages to produce a DNA profile that is then matched with Arthur Fryer in the FBI database. What was it like when you heard about this development, that there was, in fact, a match?
The process of waiting, I think it was about 2 months that it took to do the test. And, you know, even though I had waited more than 20 years to get into the lab queue, those 2 months that it took to test felt far longer than those 20 years. And the longer it went on, and I didn't hear back from the crime lab, I didn't hear back from the police, and I became convinced, the evidence isn't viable. They just don't want to tell me. You know, it was, the mood swings were intense. And finally found out it was early December, and I live in Cambridge, England, which is a beautiful city, and the Christmas decorations were up, and I was just coming home from a rehearsal that my sons were making these beautiful Christmas music. And so it was a really beautiful evening. I was walking home and my husband phoned me to tell me that the police had called and that we had a match. And that is a purely happy memory.
You write, I dry clean an outfit for court. I plan to dress carefully, makeup, blow dry, well-fitting clothes. I want to present myself flatteringly, aware that onlookers will mentally rate whether I was worth it.
Oh, yeah.
I assume they'll wonder why he bothered, end quote. I was really surprised to read this, and I'm wondering, well, why would you assume that?
Well, it's a sex crime. And being a woman just going about in your day-to-day life, you do often feel like people are judging how attractive you are. So why wouldn't that apply in a courtroom, and not just in a courtroom, in, you know, media circumstances and whatnot. I mean, it's the media aren't allowed to film victims in Pittsburgh.
Right, you're right that they were just
shooting. But they were allowed to film my feet, and that camera followed me, and it's the most unflattering angle, and it's from like my hips downward, and it's just, oh, it was so strange. And the other thing is that I wanted to make sure I wore pants, not a skirt, because one of the things being discussed in court was how he liked our legs, and I didn't want anybody to like be like, oh, he says he liked your legs, how are those legs, you know? And I hope nobody would have done that, but it's just, it's a very emotional thing to be public among strangers and talking about something so personal.
What was it like to be in the same room with Arthur Fryer again?
I had thought that that was going to be the most significant aspect of going to the preliminary hearing, which was the first step in the trial process. And it was hugely surprising to me that connecting with my old detective, who had originally had the case 20 years before, and meeting the new detectives who I had only been dealing with over email and by telephone, and meeting the assistant district attorney who was prosecuting our case, those relationships were so profound and so wonderful that they overshadowed seeing Arthur Fryer again. It was really surprising and actually very beautiful.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is Emily Winslow. Her new book is Jane Doe January, My 20-Year Search for Truth and Justice. You are a writer of crime novels where you have to decide everything, what happens and how each character will react. How different was it for you writing this book about your own true story?
I had to be patient and wait for things to happen, and I am not a patient person. And you know, there in a court case, there's a lot of waiting. And actually, it became the waiting itself became a happening and became something that I was trying to communicate in the story, and all the different all the ways that the waiting, which seems like nothing, actually provokes reactions in me and in the people around me.
A lot of us, if we were victims of a crime like this, would be analyzing all of the things that we could have or should have done differently. But you have an interesting take on that in the book. Would you share that with us?
Well, I left my apartment to get change of a dollar to do my laundry. And then I came home. And I did absolutely nothing wrong. And in particular, you know, if I could go back to that one night and maybe not go out, maybe not do my laundry, sure. But in the real world, it's not just that one night. If you want vigilance to save you, you'd have to be vigilant day after day after day. And yes, I'm careful. I'm not, you know, I don't court danger. But I don't want to live like that, where I look at everybody with suspicion. I don't want to live that way where I think, oh no, I'd better not, you know, go out. The sun has gone down. And I have to say, you know, in 46 years that I've been alive, one terrible thing has happened to me. I wouldn't want to sell all the good things or trade all the good things that have come out of living my life the way that I have just to get rid of that one bad thing.
We're down to about 30 seconds, but was it difficult to write this book, to relive so much of this?
It was absolutely essential to write the book.
You had to do it.
I had to do it. I wrote it the whole way along.
My guest has been Emily Winslow. Her new book is Jane Doe January, My 20-Year Search for Truth and Justice. Emily Winslow, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Thanks for listening, and so long for now.